Lots of reaction to our earlier contributions. Liam says, I was happy to see Martin McGuinness at the banquet last night. It's another important step in bringing our nations together. We must move on and focus on a prosperous future. I look forward to the next royal visit to Ireland. Noel says, Sean, are the British the only ones allowed to be injured and hurt? Listening to Olivia Leary and Dick Spring, one would be forgiven for thinking that. Congratulations on this programme. Shunning no controversy, you have brought out the essential triumph of peace in this great visit, says Hugh and Carlo. Liz says, three of you Southerners still don't appreciate the heart of Northerners. You didn't live there. How could you understand? It took 150 years for this event to happen. We need time too. And Eglon says, three of the greatest statespersons of our time, Michael D. Higgins, Queen Elizabeth II and Martin McGuinness. Kieran in Tralee says, as someone born in England who lived there until well into my adult life, I have always supported the establishment of an English Republic. And finally, Bill in Dublin says, Sean, please remind and inform your guest, Patrick Mercer, well, he's gone now, this country is called the Republic of Ireland, not ERA. Well, anyway, I just let that one pass an hour ago for the sake of just keeping the flow in the discussion, but a point taken at least in this studio. Now, we're going to the latest event in the President's very busy schedule on this four-day state visit. He and Mrs. Higgins have already left Windsor for a day of engagements here in London. The President will meet Prime Minister David Cameron just coming up to 1 o'clock. But before that, he has two other engagements, a visit to the Royal Society in London. And before that, again, the couple will be meeting staff at University College Hospital, from where we're joined by Fergal Keane. Fergal, good morning. This visit is all about celebrating, and it was a huge contribution, the contribution made by Irish nurses and doctors to the NHS.
That's right, Sean, and I'm standing here now at University College Hospital in London, just near Euston Station. I've been around this morning talking to some of the staff here, and there is a huge air of excitement because the number of Irish people, the nurses, doctors working here is truly extraordinary, and many of them are feeling quite emotional about this visit. He has quite a big reception committee here ready to meet him at the moment, and they're going to visit some of the wards and meet some of the staff here. Now, earlier on, just before we came on air, I went around and spoke to some of the staff, and here's some of what they had to say about this visit.
My name's Paul O'Brien. I'm a matron here at University College Hospital, and I came from a little village in Roundstone called Murvey, Connemara.
How long have you been here, and why did you decide to come to London?
So I came to London 17 years ago. I did a little pre-nursing course in Athenry, and then we all came to London to do our nurse training because there
you
wasn't
all
any positions.
Came.
Yes.
How many?
There were six of us that came from Athenry.
It's a kind of a step that people are taking now again, or have been taking in recent years.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing that come through right now, actually. We've seen quite a few nurses who've qualified most recently join UCH in the last few months. So certainly those that I've spoken to have experienced the same problems as I did 17 years ago.
Do you have any regrets?
No, I mean, I still call it home. I'm going home next week, actually, for Easter. But actually, I've had amazing opportunities here at UCLH. I'm just about to finish my master's. As I said, I'm a matron. I probably wouldn't have had those opportunities at home, so no regrets.
The President, Michael D, as we call him, will be here shortly. What will he see when he gets here? What can he expect to see?
I think he'll see a really vibrant, buzzy hospital of people who really care about what they do. And hopefully, if he gets to meet some patients who'll speak very highly of the care that they've received, because I think the care this hospital gives is fantastic.
My name is Josie Gladney, and I'm the matron for medical specialties here at University College Hospital. It's a Carlow name, very south of Carlow, St Mullins, County Carlow I'm from.
How long have you lived and worked in London?
I've been in London since 1992, so 22 years in June. I trained at home in Ireland, jobs were scarce.
Any regrets?
No regrets whatsoever, no regrets. It was a really good decision.
President Higgins is coming here this morning. Why did he pick here, do you know, and what does it mean to people here?
Well, I'd like to say he picked us because there's a lot of Irish working here, but the hospital's got a great reputation. There is a large Irish contingent working here, nurses, doctors, etc., etc. I think he'll get a great reception. I know for one, I feel extremely proud that he's picked our hospital. I feel extremely proud to be Irish and that this is part of my heritage. Today is such a historic visit. It's great to be part of that. It's also great to be part of one of the Irish people representing NHS workers across the country. And it's a proud moment for me to be able to show the President the great work we do here at University College Hospital.
A proud moment indeed, Fergal. What's the latest? The President, he's just about ready to arrive now, is that right?
He is, Sean. He's just swept past me as we were playing that piece of tape there. He's accompanied by quite a large entourage. The Eamon Gilmore was there, Sabina Higgins, and he's been met by the managers, the senior doctors of the hospital, and now he's shortly we're going to be taken on a tour to see some of the facilities and meet the staff. And one of the people who will be introducing him around is that last person you heard speaking there, Josie Gladney from County Carlow, who spoke about her time living and working in London and how beneficial it has been for her. And I would expect, going around the hospital this morning, that the President is going to get a hugely warm welcome here from the staff. It's a huge hospital. They have about 156,000 patients they deal with every year. So a very large enterprise here.
Thanks for that report. That's Fergal Keane there at University College Hospital, back with some very interesting tales from a man at the centre of events at the Savoy Hotel after this break. In the TV series Downton Abbey, the household butler Charlie Carson stays calm at all times and demands exacting standards from all his staff. In Upstairs Downstairs, the star of the show is the unswervingly loyal Hudson. A star in his own right is Limerick man, he's also Clareman, Sean Davern, the real-life head butler at London's Savoy Hotel. Sean, thank you very much indeed for taking a little break to come and join us here in studio. You took a look, I'm sure, at the proceedings last night at the state banquet. Was there anything remiss or amiss as you observed it?
No, but you have to realise that they are so meticulous when they're doing those state banquets. And, you know, that's the longest dining room table and one-piece table. And when they do the flowers for that table, they have to climb onto the table to put the flowers on. The exact detail, everything would have been measured, and the Queen would have checked that table herself before proceedings.
Now, talking about your own role in the Savoy, I gather one of your mottos is, I never say no.
No, and that's what our job is all. You have to find solutions. So whatever you're looking for, I will find. And I'll give you a little example of that, because we have a particular guest that comes that will bathe in goat's milk. But goat's milk, you can go down to the supermarket and buy. No problem, but this lady wants it straight from the goat, which means I have to send a chauffeur to Wales to pick up the milk and bring it back. And the chauffeur costs about £600 and the milk costs £25. So there's the detail that we go to for people's jobs.
And it would never strike you, I suppose it would be just not allowed, you say, are you serious to a question like that when they're asking you to get something such as goat's milk?
Well, life has taught me when you ask for something, it is must be normal to you. That's why I wear a uniform. My uniform is like my costume. And I go on show and people will ask me things and to do things. I take it on the chin. It might be slightly different if I met you down on the street or in the pub. I might have something else to say to you.
But goat's milk, I gather, and you touched on this, I think, in a talk you gave recently at the Merrick Hotel in Galway a few weeks ago. Goat's milk isn't the only unusual form of milk you've been asked to supply or source.
No, it isn't. But I can mention this person, because I'll never mention the people I look after. But a David Guest, who was married to Liza Minnelli at the time, was looking for zebra milk. And I was thinking to myself, you must be trying to rattle my cage. So I thought, OK, let me go and see how I can deal with this. I went away and I said, well, I'm going to ring the zoo, they'll call the police. And then I thought to myself, well, zebras come from Africa, so let's try an African shop, which I did. But the secret of this milk apparently is for the older man who has a younger wife. Wasn't quite sure why David Guest needed it, but at the time.
I see. And how much of it did you lay on for him?
I got actually a pint which cost £25. The only bad side of it was frozen.
And you say your policy is never to say no. Now, that doesn't mean you're able to respond or at least deliver on every request. But what about ones that you wouldn't have been able to supply?
OK, I would find a solution for you. So if I can't get you an exact thing, I'm going to get you the next best thing. And may I just add, I will do anything for you as long as it's legal. And British legal at that, because I won't do anything that's illegal. It's very important in our work that we actually remain professional at all times.
So if somebody said, I'd like a bit of good quality cocaine, sorry, can't do that.
I wouldn't be even entertaining it. And I wouldn't answer the question because I'd have walked away if you asked me that question. So I wouldn't have said no to you.
You've been sent on or asked to go on some strange errands as well. Some of them may be risky if you had known at the time what you were embarking on.
Well, you know, I never know what's going to happen during my day. I don't know who I'm going to meet. But anyway, this particular gentleman asked me to go and pick up something from a jeweller's shop. Didn't think much of it. I had took my ID and I had my down to the jeweler shop, which I walked down, which is about 15-minute walk from where I work. Picked up the piece of jewellery, small little bag, you think nothing in it, brought it back, gave it to the gentleman. And the gentleman said, would you like to see what's in the packet? Oh, I said, yes, please. So when he opened the box, it was a pink diamond, 12.5 carat or something in that line. The ring was £1.4 million that I carried on the street. And my heart just went boom, boom, boom. Because if I'd known I was picking up something so valuable, I'd have had two security men. I would have got a car to the exact door of the jeweller shop.
Now, how did you get to, really to the top rung of the ladder in the Savoy?
OK, it's by hard work, number one, and by getting grey hair and no hair. But I'll tell you the reason. I started like everybody else. In those days, it was a diploma. In hospitality. My first job then was at Claridge's. And I actually wanted to specialise in the server side of it because I was always on the server side. So I did a butlering course, which was for 5 weeks with the Guild of British Butlers, which at that time cost, I think, £4,500. And I'm talking about a couple of years ago. Those courses now are up in £10,000 to £12,000.
The tips must be great. If you're prepared to lay out that kind of money.
Well, no, the tips aren't great, but the wages are very, it's quite a different matter. And I went into private service after that for a little while, a European royal family, and then a couple of minor little families along the way, and a Middle Eastern family. But when you work in the private sector, you have to remember you're an extension onto the family. Going back to the Downton Abbey, you are the person who's going to run that house. You don't have a life. But I wanted a bit of a life because I wanted to settle down and have a family. So I went back into hotels, which I led to. My last position was because butlers became fashionable and it's in vogue to have your butler now.
And what is the difference between a butler and maybe, you know, a head waiter or somebody who would be seen as in overall charge of the hospitality okay. team?
I would be your lifestyle manager, Sean, if you needed me to make sure that your house was running smoothly, that I booked your flights for you, I looked after your transport for you, your wine cellar was full. You know, that's what you'd be wanting. All I'd want you to do is go out and make money and pay my wages. That's all I'd need you to do. Your life would be... no hassle.
Things are good, but they're not that good yet, Sean. But what about, would you give advice, for instance, on dress sense and all that kind of thing?
Okay, so this is a white tie affair. Nobody knows how to get dressed properly for some of these events, particularly if they're foreigners. They're always very nervous what they should do, what they should say, how they should courtesy to the Queen if they had meeting Her Majesty. So people would ask you those little questions. You know, table, lots of knives, forks all of a sudden, very confusing for certain people. Because the modern day, you don't see that traditional type of table settings every day in restaurants now anymore.
And do you ever panic or have you ever panicked?
No, I don't panic. But I'm like that graceful swan. I look graceful on the outside, but underneath I'm paddling like mad. Because we have, you know, there is demands met in our job and you have to achieve them.
Sean Davern, head butler at the Savoy, thank you very much for being with us. Back with further tales of Irish emigrants here in Britain after this short break. Welcome back to London. And before we hear another installment of Brian O'Connell's mini-series about Irish people working and living here, we want to go to South Africa now because state prosecutors, as you know, have started cross-examining the Olympic and Paralympic sprinter Oscar Pistorius, vowing, they say, to get to the truth surrounding the killing of his girlfriend on Valentine's Day last year. Riva Steenkamp's family are sitting through all of this. Fiona Ford is joining me now on the line. From what we heard earlier, I think in our 10 o'clock bulletin, there was some very robust questioning of Pistorius.
There was indeed, and I think what has happened in the last 10 or so minutes, Sean, is that the state has managed to change the impression left by Oscar Pistorius when he concluded his evidence in chief this morning. Cross-examination began, and he has proved to be very vulnerable in front of Harry Nell, the state prosecutor, who's been very, very, very aggressive in his line of questioning. But what has happened, the court is now adjourned. Oscar Pistorius broke down yet again. We saw that happen yesterday. It happened this morning. It has happened now again because effectively he was found to have misled the court under oath. It is a very minor issue that was brought up by the state this morning. He was asked about his religion. He was asked, would he tell the truth? He said he would tell the truth as much as, insofar as he could remember it on the night. He was asked, would he lie? He said he wouldn't lie. He would tell the truth as best he could, were his words. The next question from the state was, did he ever hear of the word zombie stopper? His answer was no. And with that, a drama followed. Essentially, the state wanted to introduce a video produced by Sky News a couple of weeks ago that showed Oscar Pistorius at a shooting range blowing apart a watermelon with a friend as a target and using the words zombie stopper, basically saying it's not as soft as brains, but it's like a zombie stopper. There was drama. The defence wanted to prevent the video being shown. The court adjourned to allow for the matter to be discussed in chambers. Court resumed. Oscar Pistorius conceded that, yes, he had in fact used those words. He couldn't remember it, but it was him. And then the state proceeded to say, OK, well, this is exactly what you did to Riva Steenkamp on the night. The bullets you put through her head had the very same effect as it had on that watermelon. Take responsibility for it. They flashed a very, very gruesome image of Riva on the floor with bullet wounds to her head. Of course, she's dead at this stage. The state asked him to take a look at this, to take responsibility for what he had done. He refused to do that. He said he's tormented by the image. He had been there on the night. He doesn't need to look at it again. And again, he broke down and the court adjourned to allow him to compose himself. And that was maybe 10 minutes ago. And he has since left the courtroom.
And interestingly, overnight in the aftermath of his emotional collapse yesterday, and it was clear that he was apparently under a lot of stress, the question was how hard would the state, or sorry, the cross-examination by the state prosecutor be, Gerry Nell, and clearly he did not hold back.
He didn't hold back, but we must remember, Sean, that the defence gave too much yesterday because they, or since Monday, they started to introduce character evidence. As soon as Pistorius took the stand on Monday, he talked about his childhood. He talked about his mum. He talked about values, religious values, who guided him in life, who was responsible for his outlook, who taught him the difference between right and wrong. There was no real reason to do that. But from once that had been entered into the court, it gave the state then the chance to come back and question him on character evidence. And that's why this video was introduced this morning. So what we had was a man who basically told the other side of the story. For the first few weeks, the state has painted a picture of a man who was reckless at times with guns, a man who was aggressive, a man who was perhaps very arrogant. We also know there was evidence in these SMSs and WhatsApp messages between he and Riva that there were times when she was afraid of him. And then when he took the stand and began to tell his side of the story on Monday, he really divided public opinion because he started to paint this very, very positive picture of himself. He was very full of remorse, which is, of course, very important for the judge to see that he's very sorry for what he did that night. But, of course, all of that has just come crashing down in the last few minutes. And Harry Nell right. very, very successfully has managed to change that opinion.
Fiona, thanks for that update. That's Fiona Ford there from the courtroom in Pretoria, back here in studio in London. We're going to have more music from Pete Quinn and Karen Ryan. Pete on keyboard, Karen on fiddle. What's it this time, Karen?
We'll do some jigs for you. We'll do Galahad's Frolics and a few others after that.
Great stuff. Thank you. Wonderful. Thanks again to Karen Ryan on fiddle and Pete Quinn on keyboard. Karen, of course, now in her 14th year as director of the Return to Camden Town Festival of Traditional Irish Music. And that's something, and song and dance as well, that I suspect some of the people we're going to hear about now appreciate very much. Brian O'Connell is with me again. Brian, yesterday you talked about the new wave of emigrants making the UK their home. Today you want to talk about some of those people who came here maybe many decades ago.
Yeah, and some of them hadn't returned for many decades. And a lot of them in East London, Sean. I think we're going to talk about East London this morning because they're people who felt, the Irish in East London, felt they've been ignored in a way. I began in a basement office in Camden this week where I met John Glynn and Alex MacDonald. Now, John was spurred into action 20 years ago, Sean, when the badly decomposed bodies of three Irishmen were found in London and nobody had claimed them. So he began an outreach programme, and that's evolved really into the Aisling Return to Home Project. And this helps organise trips home for Irish immigrants, mostly those who came here in the 50s right through to the 80s, and many of them who've never been home. So trips, really, they're brought home. They can visit the family if they want, or can just take a break from what are often chaotic and difficult lives that they lead here in the UK.
And when you talk about people being away for a long time, I gather you met one individual who hadn't been home in a very, very long number of years.
43 years. And this man, Sean Davey, alcohol was the issue for him, and while he attempted to return several times, he never quite plucked up the courage to make that journey back, that spiritual journey, as Gabriel Byrne, I think, called it when he was talking about Americans. So a few months ago, Sean Davey, with the help of the Aisling Project, he made this journey to a small rural cottage in Sligo where he grew up. And he wasn't sure, Sean, if the cottage would still be standing or what he'd find of it. But right down a narrow country lane, about a mile and a half from the main road, he found it. And as he told me his story, he had this religious statue in his hand. And I asked him first about the significance of the statue.
My mother and father were very religious people. And I remember she bought this statue in Oxrine many, many years ago.
It's a statue of the Sacred Heart of Jesus.
Sacred Heart of Jesus, yeah.
So last year you went back to visit the house where you grew up in, and that had been your first time back in Ireland for how many years?
Must be over 43, 44 years. There was reasons I didn't go back. It was a very hard thing to do, but...
And describe the scene when you walked into the house. The house was in an area, it had kind of got overgrown over the years.
It was all overgrown, right? The road that we used to use when I was living there was no longer there. It was all grown over, so we had to go in a different way. We had to park up so far and walk about a mile and a half to get to the old house. And that was overgrown as well. It was still standing.
And you obviously didn't go home for the funeral of your mum?
I didn't go home because the problem was I wasn't in any fit state to go anywhere.
And there's a lot of memories within. Even though it's overgrown, there's still a lot of memories in those four walls.
The four walls tells a story. And it still tells a story. It will tell a story. Because when I was living there, told a story, and when I went back, I told a story. So I went to see my mother and father's grave, which they're buried there. It's a decision you have to make.
And were you close over the years to going back at any time?
I was a few times, yeah. Mm. But I got a bit of the way, and we broke down after that. So at the end of the day, I had to go. Because if I didn't go right, I would never go.
And that trip home, you know, how important is that then? When you came back here, it gives you a bit of a spring in your step, I'd imagine.
You can think back, you know, that you went to the place where you were born, where you drank, where you fished, where you worked. And it slows a lot of madness in your head down. It slows a lot of problems. Because you can tell them, right, I was at home.
An extraordinary story there of an extraordinary trip, Brian.
An extraordinary trip. He has another one in a few weeks' time, and he actually found his mother's old dress still hanging up inside one of the doors in the ruins of that cottage in Sligo, and some pictures of himself when he was playing football as a child. And I know Alex and John and the Aisling Project, they were telling me that about another story, Sean, about two Irish brothers here in London. Again, haven't been home for a long, long time, and they had a third brother who died in London, so they want to bring his ashes home. And that's a trip they're going to be making. One of the brothers, when he was asked, incidentally, if he had been home, he said, "Oh yeah, I've been home a few times." John was saying, "Well, when were you home?" He said, "Well, the last time was 1952. And he pointed to his other brother and he said, "That fecker has never been home."
That's over 60 years then.
60 Brian, years, yeah.
You also met some of the older Irish community in East London.
Yeah, spurred on in part by Sally Mulready from the Irish Elderly Advice Network and a member of the Council of State. And Sally was saying to me, you know, really the media come here and you go to Cricklewood and you go to Camden and the story of the Irish in East London is often ignored. And there's about 40,000 Irish living in East London, Sean. They don't really have an Irish centre. And in the last two or three years, there's been a real effort to reach out to that community. Many of them old now, somewhat isolated, I suppose. So I went to a local community hall in Forest Gate yesterday, which is sort of between Liverpool Street Station and West Ham. And I met John O'Connor, who's chair of the Irish Pensioners Forum in East London. And he told me about dances that they're starting running now again to help try and bring the Irish community back together.
We are now where we're standing outside the reception area of the Donning Hall, which is in Forest Gate, East London. And we're just about to go inside. This is where we normally have our this is where we have our monthly socials.
Would you agree, John, that in a way the Irish community in East London has been somewhat ignored over the years?
Well, it certainly has been. It hasn't had the same attention or the same focus on East London as other parts of London, like North London, North West London, West London. Very much isolated, very much isolated. People, got, as I said, they got older. They didn't fancy coming out in the night time. So these afternoon dances, cultural events, is a great means of getting out of the house, meeting people, breaking the loneliness. It's all to do with breaking down the loneliness of people living in their homes and their flats. It's a, well, everybody focused on Camden Town, Kilburn, Cricklewood. That was the big focus. That's where the main bulk of Irish people were living. And so, of course, that is where the focus, the Irish bars, the big dance halls. The number of times we have been told that isn't it nice to come to something like this where you can meet people instead of meeting at funerals.
The President's visit this week, does it mean much, do you think, for the community here in East London?
Well, I think it means a tremendous amount. I think a tremendous amount of pride and just to listen to the radio, to hear the national anthem being played in Windsor, outside Windsor Castle, was, I mean, a tremendous moment, I think. And I was watched it last night, the news on BBC and ITV last night, right the way through from the afternoon until night time, and there wasn't a mention of the President coming over. The British media is a bit sort of laid back on it.
I suppose, Brian, with John O'Connor there, he's alluding to the fact that maybe that's a sign of the increasing normalisation of relations between the two islands.
I think so. And he was talking about the media response in advance of the visit here. He felt perhaps the media didn't give it the same build-up naturally, I suppose, as we did in Ireland. And a number of immigrants made that point, really, that they felt the media response here could have been better. But, I mean, I picked up the Evening Standard on the tube on the way home yesterday. There was maybe a tiny column buried inside the paper, Sean. And I know you've referred to it this morning as well. Now, another lady I met was Etty Kelly, and Etty lived in Forest Gates. She still lives in Forest Gates since 1956. And she chatted to me, Sean, a little bit about her life as a long-term immigrant here in the UK.
1956, my boyfriend paid for me fare. I came by air. So I came over here and I worked here as a tailoring for about until I got married. I got married the following year.
Did you marry the boyfriend?
Oh, I did. I did. I was married to him for 54 years.
Was there always a big Irish community in East London?
There was a big Irish community. Yeah. You went to 12:15 Mass in East London and you met the world and his wife.
And did you feel over the years then that the Irish community in East London didn't get as much attention as other parts of London?
Well, they say they didn't. Well, I mean, Camden Town always got the best of everything, didn't they?
And were you ever close to going back home at any time? Like to move back
home? For a year.
You did.
After Danny was born, my eldest son was born. But it was the worst move I ever made. I saw more of my family when I lived in London than when I did when I lived in Finglas. And I didn't like it one bit. I hated it. I used to cry for Green Street. That's the truth. I did. I was glad when I came back. We came back to nothing. So we started all over again.
And your view of Ireland over the years, has it changed much?
Well, you see, when I left Ireland, my nephew said to me, you took the shilling. I noticed things changed, yes. The Celtic Tiger was swinging his tail or whatever they called it, and everyone was doing well and they were earning plenty of money and everything was hunky-dory. Everyone had cars, houses, the different knows what. I just had the bus. I never had a car in my life. And then when everything went pear-shaped, you see, I took the shilling. I said, I still have the shilling.
Your husband died 2 years ago, so a difficult adjustment given that you were married for 54 years?
54 years, yes.
How have you found the last 2 years?
All right. You see, he was in a nursing home for 2 years before he died, or 2.5 years. He gave up work when he was 52, and I worked till I was 74. And the day Danny went back to America, that was in 1989, Johnny gave up working and sat in the corner. It was drink-related too. It's a shame that things happened like that, but they did. He did mean things on me, but I rose above it.
Did he ever apologise towards the end?
Oh, he did towards the end. Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, he did. He was sorry we never bought a house. He was sorry he did for many a thing he did. I mean, he did. Yeah, I forgave him, of course. You had to. I hope he's happy wherever he is now.
Maybe, I won't say 50 years living in East London, but a good few years ahead anyway.
Well, I'm 84 now.
You don't look 84.
Well, I am. I'm 84 now, so I'll be 85 in June.
You'll see the 100.
But do you think so?
You get a check.
I get a check. Well, a check from himself.
Well, if you meet him, you could get a deposit on it.
And that's Etty Kelly there, Brian. You and she having a bit of a laugh and a bit of banter there. She's living there for over half a century, as you say, in Forest Green. And you're going to stay in touch, I gather, with the Aisling Return to Ireland project.
Yeah, and I think what we might do is follow some of those stories when they do come to Ireland in a couple of weeks' time. Extraordinary tales, spiritual journeys home. And well done to John Glynn and the Aisling Return to Home project.
Okay, Brian, thanks for that. We'll be back with more from London after this break. You're welcome back to the programme today, coming to you from London, marking the state visit of President Higgins to the United Kingdom. But we're going straight back now to Dublin and some breaking news in the Anglo trial. We're joined by our legal affairs correspondent, Orla O'Donnell. Orla, what's been happening today?
Yes, there's been some legal argument, Sean, and the jury came back into court at around 11:30 this morning. And they were told by Judge Martin Nolan that he's directed them to bring in not guilty verdicts in relation to some of the charges in this case. First of all, the former chairman of Anglo-Irish Bank, Sean Fitzpatrick, is no longer facing charges that he illegally lent money to Sean Quinn's family. He was facing 16 charges of giving unlawful financial assistance to 16 people to buy shares in Anglo. Six of the charges related to the Quinn family, 10 relate to the Maple 10. So the jury has been directed to find him not guilty on the six counts relating to the Quinn family. He still faces charges of giving unlawful financial assistance to the Maple 10. Then in relation to Patrick Whedon, who was the director of lending in Ireland in Anglo, he was charged, as well as the 16 charges of giving unlawful financial assistance, he was charged with seven counts of being involved in the alteration of loan facility letters in October 2008. And the judge said he had directed the jury to bring in not guilty verdicts on those charges as well. So he said that he had made these decisions for a good reason. He said it will all be made apparent to you in due course, and it had happened after legal argument.
Okay, Orla, thank you for that update from the courts in Dublin, and no doubt more about that on the News at One and subsequent programmes back here in London. Given that we're at the heart of Westminster, it would be strange for us not to have a look at the British political scene as it stands, and as is the case at home. Looming on the horizon here are the local and European elections, and the big question, of course, is how well will Nigel Farage and his UK Independence Party, that's UKIP, fare, and how much damage will UKIP inflict on Labour, and in particular the Conservatives. Joining me now, Conservative MP Nadine Dorries. She's on the telephone. Also in studio, Labour MP Pat McFadden from Wolverhampton, and also the London editor of the Irish Times, Mark Hennessy. First of all, Mark, UKIP seem to be making great strides, if you were to take it certainly on the basis of polls and on TV performances.
They have been making great strides, definitely in terms of the top line public attention in them. Now, the question is whether they can produce that on the boards on the day of the election. I think in terms of the European elections, they are going to do very well. The question now is whether they're going to come close or beat Labour in terms of preference vote, or share of the vote, more accurately. And that's not clear. The Tories have been attempting to talk up UKIP's likely performance with the hope of trying to keep their people calm afterwards. But there's no doubt that UKIP are going to do very well, and there's no doubt equally that that is going to impact on political opinion thereafter. And regardless in some ways whether they do well or not, UKIP has substantially changed the political weather by their very existence in Britain. They have forced David Cameron to become more Eurosceptic in his top-line messaging.
Nadine Dorries, do you think that UKIP represent a big challenge to Cameron? You have been critical of himself and indeed George Osborne in the relatively recent past by describing them as two arrogant posh boys who show no remorse. So how vulnerable are they?
Well, I think David Cameron and George Osborne are both very honourable, but in terms of the substance of your question into the threat that UKIP present, I think they present a threat to the entire political establishment. We're not having a very good day here in Parliament today with the resignation of our Culture Secretary, and yet another expenses issue has hit the headlines. And I think that until David Cameron and Ed Miliband get together and decide that all expenses for MPs in Parliament are scrapped, and I speak as one who doesn't claim any, and that we bring back recall for members, then I think until we do something pretty substantial like that to try and encourage people to have faith once again in Parliament and in politicians, then we are going to be damaged. I think, unfortunately, expenses issues like the one that has happened today is driving people away from both Labour and Conservative Party into the protest party, which is now UKIP, who have, in terms of poll ratings, taken the third place as a political party in the UK.
Pat McFadden, prior to this, I think UKIP were seen primarily as threatening the Tories, but it seems they want to eat Labour's dinner as well.
I think that's true, and I think it would be complacent for any Labour MP to think that UKIP was only a phenomenon that could hurt the Tory party. I don't believe that. I think it can hurt both parties. And I think that this is part of a really important debate for the United Kingdom, because at the heart of this is what kind of country do we want to be? You know, in the face of globalisation and a more interconnected world, are we going to retreat? Are we going to, you know, become Little England, or are we going to stay as Great Britain? And I think this is a really important debate. I think the threat to leave the European Union is a mistake. I don't think it's in the United Kingdom's interests. And I think that this has been driven by immigration to a big extent, and something of a lack of leadership which has not been there to make the case for the UK to stay engaged in the world and to understand the way that the world is changing, rather than retreat from that change, which is really what the UKIP message is.
And Mark, just to go back to something that Nadine referred to there, that's the resignation of the Culture Secretary this morning. And Maria Miller, she hung on and clung on for a long time. It struck me, and maybe it was my imagination at the time, that David Cameron and Nick Clegg looked quite preoccupied as they sat there during President Higgins' address yesterday. They've a lot on their mind politically.
They have. I mean, this is a disaster for not just for the Conservatives, but for all parties. In the last few days, it's been quite evident talking to MPs how concerned they are that the message that's yet again gone abroad to the British public is that all MPs are fiddling their expenses. Now, the Miller story is far more complicated than that, and she has grounds for defence, but it's the usual story when you're explaining you're losing. Now, how you change that in a culture where people are becoming more anti-authority and disliking all messages coming from political parties is impossible. You know, the idea of abolishing expenses is fine. You replace it by some form of per diem system so that people have the ability to actually pay for a bed in central London. That isn't significantly going to change the order of the events. Politicians are being affected by changing rules. They are affected by a system that they want to control, and yet the increasing public demand is for some form of outside control.
Do you think it's possible, Nadine, that she might be replaced by another woman? Might there be significance in that?
I think an announcement might, or Mark might know better than me because I've been in the meeting, but I think the announcement might already have been made in the last half an hour. I just want to check about something that Mark just said about the expenses being abolished and replaced with per diems wouldn't be enough. I think for MPs in going hand in hand with the abolition of expenses. Yes, of course, accommodation in Westminster has to be provided for, and perhaps one travel from your constituency to London per week. But that's it. MPs shouldn't be claiming meals or anything else. And I think that's what I don't think the public have a stomach for another reform or another independent body. They were given all that in 2010. IFSA was supposed to be the independent body. The public have been given that. They still haven't got any faith. They don't see it working. And I think the word expenses in terms of parliamentarians is toxic. And so I think it has to go. And hand in hand, there has to be another measure, which has to be recall, so that any MP who is found guilty of any wrongdoing can be recalled to Parliament. And I think those two things, hand in hand, will go some way to reassuring the British public that we mean business. And I think it will go some way to giving the British public faith in the established parties and stop them leaving and flooding both Labour, away from Labour and Conservative, into the arms of protest parties.
It's remarkable, I suppose, one might observe, how similar the issues are that get people's backs up, that get them really angry, both here and back home in Ireland. But Pat McFadden, one of the things that seems to have caught the public imagination is the repeated emphasis by your own party leader, Ed Miliband, with the cost of living crisis. You seem to be scoring with that.
Yeah, I mean, we've got economic recovery underway in the UK after some very, very tough years. And this will be familiar to listeners in Ireland, I think, you know, where obviously there's been very tough economic times too. And, you know, I very much welcome the fact that we've got some economic growth back, that the years of flatlining and recession appear to be coming to an end, but people aren't feeling it in their pockets. And there's a lot of figures being bandied around, but our very respected Institute of Fiscal Studies thinks that when you take into account all the tax and benefit changes in the last 4 years, not just picking out one that might look good, but taking them all together, that the average family is down over £900 a year. And against that backdrop, when you look at a GDP figures that might be going up a couple of percent, it's good to hear. It's moving in the right direction, but people are not feeling it in their pockets. And that's why I think sometimes talk of recovery sounds a bit odd to the public. And that's why Ed Miliband has focused on this. He's focused on energy prices. He's focused on trying to promote a living wage. He's focused on things that will increase the amount of money in people's pockets and try and take some pressure off the family budget. And it is a very important theme for us right now.
Mark, how much traction now is Miliband getting with the electors? Because he was seen certainly in the media as not quite cutting it up now, but is it starting to come around for him?
Well, I mean, if you were here last week or the week before, the talk was exactly the opposite, that Labour were not making the kind of ground, and some of his own people were beginning to get concerned that clear enough messages were not being thrown out. Now, if you look at his comments last autumn about electricity prices, he definitely scored. No doubt about that whatsoever, although it has to be argued that there are more than a few people around who would make the point that his argument was economically illiterate, and what it has done is impacted upon spending decisions by electricity companies in Britain. There is one fundamental problem which has been building up here for 30 years, and because of the privatisation and the way it was done under the Thatcher era, there's 130 billion that has to be spent on improving the national grid to ensure that the lights go out. That's got, before you actually start increasing the supply of power, you have to increase the mechanism that carry the power. And when that is the situation, the kind of authority and leverage that any government has to hold on to down prices is limited.
I want to spend the last couple of minutes talking to our other two guests primarily about their own personal backgrounds, because Nadine, I think you will have come to people's attention back home for your role in I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here series. People will have seen you on TV3 or ITV. It got you into political trouble, from which you just managed, I think, fairly recently to claw your way back.
I think it's more than fairly recently, it's a while ago. I think one of the things about I'm a Celebrity, because this is the British media, I'm afraid, is that Parliament was actually on holiday at the time. We were on recess. I missed no government legislation and no government votes. But unfortunately, the media didn't report that. I think what's more relevant, actually, as of my own background, I am from an Irish Catholic background, and I've just written a book called The Four Streets, which is about an Irish community settling in Liverpool.
I was going to come to that.
I'm still doing other things.
Before I talk to you about the book, it wasn't just the media. I think your own party hierarchy took a dim view of your absence for whatever reason. But how have you been getting on, and what was the reaction you got on the ground when you went knocking on doors in your constituency?
Oh, fantastic. My constituents have been amazing. And what it's also done is I've connected with a whole new group of younger constituents. You know, whereas I struggled to break through with the, 15, 16, 17-year-olds before, they've just loved it. So, no, it's been great. It's been it was a really good experience. I wouldn't recommend it for every politician. I don't think Pat should actually think about doing it yet, but it was something I certainly don't regret, and my constituents actually loved it.
And tell me about this novel. It's set in Liverpool in an Irish Catholic kind of background. Is that right?
Well, it is, because it's where I come from. It's set in an Irish Catholic community in the middle 1950s in Liverpool, which is where my family's origins are from. And yes, it was publicised. Yes, it's called The Four Streets. And it's set very much, and the second one actually is set also partly in Ireland, but it's set very much against the background of my upbringing, which was in the midst of my Irish family, first generation immigrants from Ireland, and it's about all it's about the warmth and the love and the way people support each other through very impoverished, difficult times, which is missing today.
And the name of the book, the book's title?
The book's called The Four Streets.
The Four Streets. Very good. Yeah. Well, look, Nadine, thank you very much indeed for coming on the line. And I suspect a lot of people will be interested in taking a look at that one, maybe in the bookshops, and who knows, they might walk out with it in their bags as well. Of course, having paid for it, needless to say. Pat McFadden, you were born in Scotland in Paisley. You represent Wolverhampton South East, but with a name like McFadden, surely there has to be a connection in the northwest of Ireland.
Oh, very much so. My parents grew up on farms next door to one another in just outside Falkara in County Donegal. They came to Scotland in the 1950s, as so many people from that part of the world did. My dad worked on the building sites in Glasgow for his whole life, really. And my mum, she did a number of jobs, but the main one was in a local authority children's home. So they were very typical and representative of their generation. They were both native Gaelic speakers and they came to Scotland, and that Irish background was very, very important to me and to my brothers and sisters when we were growing up.
Are there many MPs with similar Irish roots?
Oh, there are. There are a few. You talked to Nadine there, Siobhan McDonough in London, Chris Rann in North Wales. There are a number of MPs with Jim Murphy as well in the Shadow
John
Cabinet.
Cruddas is another. He's one of your Labour colleagues. Yeah.
So there are plenty of people in Parliament. And, it's part of the education story as well, because our parents never got the chance to do further or higher education. And we were really the first generation that did. And that's why some of us are doing these kind of
jobs.
And
from each of you, in 20 seconds, a comment on this state visit, Mark.
It is extraordinary how things have gone so well. It is perhaps slightly a problem that so much of day one was dominated by Northern Ireland and by Barton McGuinness rather than about the full context of British-Irish relations.
And Pat?
I think it's a really important moment. It's the culmination of a thawing and a warming of relations that's been taking place over a number of years, and it really should remind us how much we've got in common rather than perhaps some of the emphasis on division that we've had in the past.
Well, that's, I think, something we've brought to the fore in the last 2 days, and we've certainly enjoyed making the programmes here. Pat McFadden, Nadine Dorries, and also Mark Hennessy, thank you for being with us. That's our lot from London. The programme today produced by Tara Campbell in London, with Conor Kavanagh in Dublin, researched by Adele Coffey, on sound here in Milbank, Richie McCullough and Gar Duffy in Dublin, and our thanks also to Tom Norton and other colleagues. We'll be back in Dublin tomorrow, but right now we're going back there and to Ronan.